Montreal. You're listening to Femme AM, Concordia's only feminist talk show, here on CJLO 1690 AM, the campus community radio station. Thanks for tuning in. My name is Melanie, and I'm here with Mac and Sophia.
Hello!
Hi. Hey, and we've got a fun show ahead for you today, but insightful as well. We're talking about women in film. So throughout today's episode, we'll be talking about how female-presenting characters and their stories are represented in mainstream film. We'll be looking at some of the eye-rolling female character tropes that crop up again and again. We'll discuss a little tool that you may have heard of called the Bechdel test and how we can go beyond that. We'll talk about how the industry falls short on diversity, and we'll hear from some local Montreal organizations working to support women and feminist issues in the industry. There's more. In the second half of the show, we'll chat with a student from the Concordia Film Studies program and then open up the discussion to the Women's Plus Collective. All right. It's going to be a good one. So I wanted to start off the show just with a few stats to kind of set the scene, give us a little bit of context. So there's a study last year in 2017 called It's a Man's Celluloid World: Portrayals of Female Characters in the 100 Top Films of 2017. This study was done by the Center for the Study of Women in Television and Film, and they found that females comprised only 24% of protagonists in top-grossing films, actually a decline of 5 percentage points from the previous year. Ooh. Yeah, and in those films, females accounted for 37% of major characters, so not necessarily protagonists, but still considered a major character in the film, and 34% of speaking roles, either major or minor. But that being said, male characters continue to dominate on the big screen. While only 32% of films featured 10 or more female characters in speaking roles last year, 79% had 10 or more male characters. So
wow.
It absolutely does. And I mean, we are consumers of media, and we do see that that representation is not necessarily there. It's not how it should be. And, you know, it's a male-centered society that values and rewards male-centered stories. So we continue to see that happening in the mainstream, those behind the scenes, the storytellers, which we'll talk a little bit more in a bit. It tends to be dominated by those male voices and male perspectives. So I wanted to start us off by jumping into kind of a fun little dissection of some
fun
of the
and how horrible some of them are.
Mm-hmm. A dissection of some of those female character tropes that we're so prone to seeing.
Well, because they're just so ridiculous.
Films. Yeah, exactly.
So it's kind of fun how ridiculous they are.
Yeah, they're fun. They're fun in how ridiculous they are, but in the way that they're normalized, that's mm-hmm. where it gets a lot less fun.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. I feel that. Yeah. And some of these you may recognize. Some of them might be a little bit new to you and, you know, have a little light bulb moment go off in your head. But regardless, you've definitely encountered some of these. So in general, by and large, female characters are portrayed as a love interest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
A supporting role, a mother, a wife, or a girlfriend.
Gotta have that support for the that central male character.
Yeah. Yeah. They're often seen as powerless or victimized. Help me, Superman. Mm-hmm. Or as the virgin or the whore. I think I can say that. I don't know.
In these terms, yes.
In these terms, yes. Yes.
So you guys know what we mean.
So they often lack speaking roles. They are objectified. They are submitted to the male gaze. Their stories and actions are usually dependent on male characters and male story arcs, and therefore they lack an inner life that drives their decision making. Oftentimes, you know, that's even if they are given decision making at all in the film. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what a trope is it's a recognizable element of a story that defines or conveys information about a character. So it is oftentimes used as a plot driver, which lends itself to having flat characters that don't necessarily have an inner life. They don't necessarily have that kind of process.
They're one-dimensional.
They're very one-dimensional. Yep.
They're one-dimensional, exactly. And they rely on, like, this cultural, like, recognition kind of thing too. Mm-hmm. So you know Absolutely. The type, so you just are like put your assumptions on this character instead of actually having the writer develop this character.
You could almost interchange the term with stereotypes. Some of these yeah. things are mm-hmm. stereotypes of people because we recognize those things, and so we could say, oh, I know exactly what that character is thinking, what's driving them, and what their part mm-hmm. in this.
And it's kind of lazy
be.
Too.
Mm-hmm, absolutely,
it's like lazy writing.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, exactly. So we had some in mind to talk about, but maybe I'll turn it over to you, Sophia. You had one in particular.
Yeah, so the manic pixie dream girl trope is what I was wanting to talk about. I feel like it has gained a lot of popularity recently. I think it's a very mm-hmm. well-known trope that it's like a word that people are throwing around a lot. At least I throw it around a lot. One of my friends who's in this collective, actually, Lily Roy, dressed up as a manic pixie dream squirrel for Halloween. Not a lot of people like got the message, but
that's my kind of costume.
Yeah, I thought it was super creative. Yeah. So shout out to Lily Roy. But yeah, I think I'm just so fascinated with this trope because I feel like it's, if I had to simplify myself to a film trope, I think it would probably be a manic pixie dream girl. Like, it's something that I've seen in a lot of movies and subconsciously almost aspired towards in a weird way. I hate to say
it,
but I
definitely relate to that because, like, it's so prevalent in, like, more like the indie kind of alternative
yes.
culture.
Exactly.
It's a big thing.
It's one of the primary indie film tropes. Like, a lot of these tropes are seen in popular movies and like big cinemas, mm-hmm. but this is one that's like more alternative. Maybe that's why I relate to it, because I'm alternative. I don't know, but I mean, I'm not saying I relate to it, but it's just always interested me, and I feel like I've almost suffered from the consequences of this trope in mm-hmm. my real life. Like, in some romantic situations, I feel like I've had guys sort of place the manic pixie dream girl thing onto me.
I definitely relate to that because it's like, yeah, it's like you see the indie culture through this lens of the film, and then that's how women are portrayed, so that's how women get treated.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I just have a bit of a personal relationship with this trope. So I did a bit of research. The term was actually coined in 2005 by Nathan Rabin, I want to say is his last name, and it was describing Kirsten Dunst's character in Elizabethtown. I haven't seen that movie, but it's like Kirsten Dunst. I feel like she plays a lot of the same sort of characters, so you can kind of imagine. And I have a quote here where he talks about the trope. So he says, it exists, or she exists, solely in the fevered imaginations of sensitive writer-directors to teach broodingly soulful young men to embrace life and its infinite mysteries and adventures. I think that sums it up pretty well. So, like what you were saying earlier, the biggest problem with these tropes is that it's one-dimensional. So she is as like ethereal and magical as she is. She doesn't really develop. She doesn't have an arc. She exists purely for the male protagonist to help him discover like the magic of life and rediscover his own potential. So that's one of the biggest problems. I have a list of some manic pixie dream girls, but a lot of these are like from older movies as well. This isn't the term was coined recently, but for example, I was looking on this list and Maria from The Sound of Music was on there, so I think that's debatable. I think it's debatable, but I can see elements.
Well, I find that a lot of more recent movies, it's debatable if it's like they definitely have elements of manic pixie dream girl, but it's whether it goes beyond that or it doesn't. And a lot of movies fall short.
The thing is, okay, so, and this is a really big debate within the whole manic pixie dream girl like dialogue, is that just because a character is quirky and alternative and spunky doesn't mean she's automatically a manic pixie dream girl per se. And it's not a bad thing to have this character that like is those things. It's the problem is the fact that she's one-dimensional and isn't the protagonist of her own story. And there was actually Zoe Kazan. I'm really bad with last names, but she starred in Ruby Sparks. She also wrote the screenplay. And she was interviewed and she described, here I have it here, she described the manic pixie dream girl quote as reductive, diminutive, and misogynistic. And she said, to quote, I think that to lump together all individual original quirky women under that rubric is to erase all difference. So I do think she has a point there. And it's the fact that the term was being like thrown around so frequently and people were just saying, oh, she's a manic pixie dream girl, like just dismissing it. And that's not the point.
Well, it's meant to point out an issue that is happening and a way that characters aren't necessarily being developed and being pigeonholed for the purposes of advancing a male character.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is the main point of that trope and pointing that out, having the terminology.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, I mean, there are definitely examples of that in more recent films. But there are also some more tropes to talk about. We'll just kind of list off a few more of them here. You know, you have the femme fatale or the evil demon seductress. Those are kind of, that kind of fall into the similar category.
I have an interesting story about this is like a very old Hollywood reference, but one of the first femme fatale kind of characters that we saw was Theda Bara. She was typecast to play a lot of like vamps, and it was this idea of basically like this sexualized women who brings the downfall of a male hero, and it was like kind of like against family values and such. And what happened with this trope, it was like her story was like extremely publicized, so this was when public magazines were beginning, and she gave this interview, and this is in the 1920s, and she said outwardly, I'm a feminist, and like I definitely believe in feminist values. But because she was portrayed as being this femme fatale character, she was being portrayed constantly as the enemy. So it was kind of this like, even if she was saying that she was a feminist, it was very like anti-feminist in that this the way this woman was being portrayed.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Huh, that's really interesting. Yeah.
But femme fatales are one of like the tropes that interest me a lot. If you watch any like film noir kind of thing, there's always one lurking in the background to like bring the downfall of some man.
Yeah. We'll just list off a couple more here before our quick commercial break. But, you know, there's the Ice Queen or the boss, often a kind of an older woman who has been desexualized in order to be ambitious.
Yeah, which I really, I dislike it because it's like you can't have it all.
Exactly.
You can't be sexually assertive and like have a
success.
I guess be successful. Like male characters are allowed to have it all.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't see that with female characters.
On that note, there's the Ugly Duckling transformation where, you know, again, it's kind of linking.
Oh my God, Anne Hathaway?
Good looks to success.
Anne Hathaway in Princess Bride?
Mm-hmm.
That's like that. That just popped into my head. I feel like that's a good example of that.
The Princess Diaries.
Oh my God. Princess Diaries, not Princess Bride. Two very different movies.
There's the girls with guns. You've got the strong girls. And then there's also the Smurfette principle. That's kind of the token woman in any larger group. I'd like to quickly point out that there are harmful representations of men in film as well. But they kind of still are within that context of male-centered stories and male characters generally developing over the course of a film.
And they're not as frequent.
And they're
as
not
well,
as frequent.
I'd
exactly.
Say. Or they are often to do with like things like race or like racialized male characters. Like that happens a lot.
Exactly. So you're listening to Femme AM on CJLO 1690 AM, Concordia's only feminist talk show. We're talking about women in film, and we're going to take a short commercial break.
This is Nick from Mauno, and you're listening to CJLO 1690 AM in Montreal.
Welcome back to Femme AM on CJLO. Before the break, we were exploring some common tropes of female characters in film. And now we're going to talk a little bit about an indispensable tool, another one of those tools used to kind of illuminate a problem, and this being the problematic representation of women in film. Take it away, Mac. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I'm going to talk about the Bechdel test. This test was created by comic book artist Alison Bechdel in 1985, and it first appeared as a comic strip called The Rule as part of a series called Dykes to Watch Out For. And it was adopted as this baseline measure to evaluate the presence of film. So the rule goes, it's very simple. There are three parts to it. One, a woman needs to have at least two named female characters. Two, they have to talk to each other. And three, they have to talk to each other about something other than a man. And you'd be surprised how many movies fail this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it is very surprising.
And it's such simple criteria.
Literally. It's
it's not a lot to ask for.
It's not a lot to ask for. And why this test is important, because it criticizes how often female characters in film live in completely in relation to the Met. Mm-hmm. It's like they're just like around this like nucleus that is the central male character, and it rids them of autonomy, and that's very dangerous, like representing that. Yeah, so we have to be really aware of how this plays out. And not only this, this is obviously like relevant to women, but you can also apply this test to other things. There's the racialization of the Bechdel test. So it goes that a film has to have two people of color who talk to each other about something other than a white person. This test also exists.
That's really cool. Yeah, yeah, I didn't actually know that.
And if you thought movies already fared really badly with a Bechdel test, they're even worse with the POC Bechdel test.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I don't know if you remember this, but a few, maybe like 2-3 years ago, there was this like viral YouTube thing that was every single word spoken by a person of color in and a bunch of movies.
Yeah.
And like some examples that I pulled out are like there's one that's the entire Harry Potter franchise, and the amount of spoken words by a person of color equates to 6 minutes and 19 seconds.
Whoa!
Crazy.
And how long is that, like, that's several, like seven, what, eight movies? That's
eight movies of like 2 hours.
That's like 2 days of, or like a day. Oh my God.
Yeah. Titanic, the like, like behemoth of a movie that is, 55 seconds. And
of
then.
Of course. Oh my
God. Juno, a minute and 26. But yeah, but also if you take the time to go on YouTube and watch these, you also get a sense of what the people of color are talking about, and it's always about a white person, pretty much.
Well, and oftentimes the argument will be used that it's a reflection of the times, that script is a reflection of the times, which is just such a flat argument.
But like, even if you want to look at Gone with the Wind, obviously Gone with the Wind isn't a great example, because the main person of color in this movie is a slave, but still managed to speak for like a whopping 14 minutes, which is a lot compared to how we've been doing in recent years.
A whopping 14 minutes. A whopping look at that, you guys. Oh my God.
So, sad. Yeah. Well, talking about that, because, you know, we're kind of shifting this into diversity a little bit, and representations of diverse populations, is that the numbers, the stats reflect that as well. You know, we were talking about a 34% representation of female characters in films. For people of color, it's so much less. And I'm not sure if this is specifically women of color.
I also have some more stats specifically about, like, speaking roles. So, there's also a study that was done on Polygraph by Hannah Anderson and Matt Daniels, and it was a breakdown of Disney movies. And you'd think that, that Disney movies, especially Disney princess movies, would have good female representation. So what they did was they looked at how many speaking roles and how many words are spoken by women versus men. So they made a gender breakdown of it, and out of 30 movies that they looked at, only 22 of them were over 60% spoken dialogue was by men. And
in the princess movies?
In princess movies. Like,
how do you even do that, though? It's about, it's like, what?
Honestly, it's because, like, the default for side characters is...
Oh, because there are a lot of the male... There's the male sidekick, kind of.
You need the...
or, like, the male creature sidekick kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like,
even think about Little Mermaid, whose voice is literally taken away.
Little Mermaid's on my
list. Actually, now that I'm thinking about it, it makes sense, because Little Mermaid, she loses her voice. Sleeping Beauty... She's asleep.
Sleeping Beauty passes, though.
Half the time. Oh, does it?
Sleeping Beauty is one of
I'm so confused,
it's
though.
Because of the three fairies.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So the movies that I listed as like Disney princess movies that don't have is Little Mermaid, Pocahontas, Mulan as a few examples. If you want to go online and look up the Polygraph study, you can see that a lot more. And another problem of diversity with female characters that you could look at is also ageism. This study, this specific study also looked at the age of characters speaking, and I think that's really important if you're going to study representation in film, because you look at it and the graph goes, it's mostly women between 22 and 30 who are the main characters, and then you just see it go down from there. Mm. And then male characters, it goes up. Old wise men, very valuable.
So true.
Old wise women, crazy lady. But yeah, and this is a problem across Hollywood, is that older female actresses often rely on like playing mothers, because those are the only roles available. But they're literally so like, it's so tragic, because you're basically telling women that, okay, your life is not interesting after you stop being sexually desirable in your 20s. And that's horrible.
And you'll often have younger women being cast as those older roles.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And so that leaves this huge gap.
Because actresses need to be attractive, even though lots of people in this world aren't. So why? Anyway.
Well, and not just not attractive, just like a different way of viewing people, instead of like fitting them all into this kind of quote unquote attractive,
or this like
box.
Just like traditionally attractiveness. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, I saw like a similar sort of graph thing showing in like films with like a female love interest and a male love interest, like showing the ages between the two and comparing them. And I think they found like one example where the girl was older, like the female love interest was older than the male one, but there's usually a vast age difference, like a 10 to 20, if not more, year difference.
Especially in older movies, you see that like men in their early 50s dating like women. Like Jimmy Stewart's career lasted throughout like from the 1930s to the 1960s. And in that time, there's so many young actresses that like switch through, and there's so much more turnover because their careers are shorter. I want to end going back a little bit on the Bechdel test, on being in film school and learning about the Bechdel test, because a lot of things that people say in film school or like in film in general is, oh, the next generation is going to be better. Things are going to change. Now we know about these things. But unfortunately, it isn't so. I took a script writing class this semester, and part of the class, what we had to do is read each other's script. And it was so sad. But a lot of the men in the class, and even some women, their scripts didn't pass the Bechdel test, for one. Mm. And for two, there were horrible representations of women. But we never really talked about that. We never really talked about in class, how do we cover stories that we're not looking at right now?
Right.
Because that's not really an issue in Hollywood. It's about selling scripts. So I read this article called by Jennifer Kessler, and it's called Why Film Schools Teach Screenwriters Not to Pass the Bechdel Test. So Kessler talks about learning how to write stories around white, straight, male-centered films, but she also wanted to make these films pass the Bechdel Test, even though she was fitting in the mold of, like, the white male is at the center of the universe. But she had a lot of trouble selling these scripts, even though she had two female characters with names have an intelligent conversation as part of the story. So she had this conversation with an industry pro, and he said to her, the audience doesn't want to listen to a bunch of women talking about whatever women talk about. And she asked,
whatever women talk about. Whatever. Who knows?
Who knows what women talk about?
Periods.
So in response, she asks, not even if it advances a story. And then he says, I mean, that's not how I see it. That's how they see it, referring to the audience. And men in the film industry seem to have this construct that, oh, the audience doesn't want it. It's not our problem. It's the problem of the audience. But really,
right, yeah.
When you think about it, it's Hollywood producers pushing this status quo and like taking the blame away from themselves so they can actually like fulfill their desires of having all the women in their films cater around their universe.
Yeah, that's such an empty argument, the whole thing of, oh, like the audience wants it. Like, that's just, it's what we've known this whole time. So, you know, like, I think the hype around movies like Bridesmaids, for example, really just shows that, no, people want to see themselves in movies. Like,
yeah. One example.
Like, that's just one example.
One quick example for like action movies, which is this person's genre. Like, if you look at Mad Max that came out a few years ago.
Right, yeah.
The story, it's an action movie, like traditional, quote-unquote male, though that's another problem. And yeah, at the center of it is strong female characters doing their thing and talking to each other about taking down the bad guy or whatever happens in action movies.
Yeah, absolutely. So that obviously enlightening stuff. If you ever have the chance to look up the Bechdel test, if you haven't heard it before, make sure you do that and start applying it to the films that you see and try to go beyond it even a little bit, I think. Keep it tuned to Femme AM here. We're just going to be back right after this.
CJLO Radio.
Welcome back. You are listening to Femme AM on Concordia University's only feminist talk show. Today we're talking about women in film. I'm going to take, we're running a little bit behind schedule. I'm going to take a couple minutes just to talk about, switch gears and talk about the behind the scenes, the storytellers. Because again, there is still not a great representation of women behind the scenes, being directors, behind writers, the scenes, yeah. Producers, executive producers, editors, cinematographers. All of those things. So, you know, I think that is even, the percentages are even lower than the representation of women on screen.
Like, the more technical it gets, I think, like, the lower.
Exactly. I spoke this week with a couple of people in Montreal doing work to support women in the industry. I spoke to Brigitte Monod. She's the executive director of the, that's a French acronym for Women in Film, Television, and Digital Media in Montreal. And they are an organization that is, it was founded in 1991 as the Montreal chapter of a more international movement, the Women in Film and Television. So they've got kind of chapters around the world, loads of members, and the goal being to increase female representation in these industries. So what FTCMN does, they celebrate the accomplishments of women in the industry. They support women with professional and career development, mentorship, networking opportunities. She said to me, we want to put women in this industry on the map. So they are working, for example, with the National Film Board to compile a list of women in the industry that will eventually become a living, working database of women so that we can actually, and on that note, the National Film Board about 3 years ago announced that it was providing funding 50%. It was creating parity for the funding for women and for men. So that organization and then a couple others followed suit quickly. That's... So yeah, they've got a gala event celebrating. There's five women and one man, actually the director from the National Film Board, who was responsible for that kind of parity shift.
Right.
So they're having a gala celebration on May the 2nd, if that is of interest to you. And then I spoke with the Montreal Feminist Film Festival.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's another event that's coming up very quickly. I spoke with Magenta Baribeau. She's the founder of the festival. Surprisingly, it was only founded last year.
Wow.
I totally expected there have been a bit of a history of this festival, but no, the second year, but their first year was really, really strong. It's coming up again May 5th to 13th. And I asked her a little bit about how the festival got started. And here's what she had to say.
I got the idea to start the Montreal Feminist Film Festival because I got the chance to travel with my feature film, which is called Maman Non Merci, No Kids For Me, Thanks. And so I was selected in different feminist film festivals around the world. So I went to the London Feminist Film Festival in 2015, and then to the Berlin Feminist Film Week in 2017. Yeah. And I found those festivals to be so amazing. And it was really welcoming and great to see feminist works on the big screen. Because as you know, not just feminist works, but anything that is produced by a woman does not get to screen as much as films made by men. And then, especially as a feminist film, if it's made by a person of color, if it's made by a trans person, then they don't get to screen almost at all. Which is too bad because there's so much creativity out there. And so experiencing those festivals abroad made me think we really, really need one in Montreal. Like, I can't believe we don't have one. So that's why I'm the type of person that goes like, when there's something missing, I'm like, well, I'm going to do it. So that's how it came about.
Yeah. So when I asked Magenta about the transition of getting some of this kind of content into the mainstream, she references the idea that feminist issues are considered controversial. Like she kind of mentioned that film that she's working on. And in fact,
they're not controversial, no. But there is this idea out there that the lived realities of women in marginalized populations, you know, just because they're not seen in the mainstream, it's controversial. So she had this to say about that.
For us, it's mostly like a festival about inclusion more than just feminism, but they do have to have a feminist message. And so that means fighting sexism, exclusion, talking about issues that are never talked about. So this year we have films depicting the reality of Black women, of people living with disability, of trans and non-binary people. So it's like issues that are really part of feminism and that don't really get to screen. Like, when's the last time you saw a film about non-binary people on a big screen? Like, that almost never happens, and this is too bad. Personally, as a woman and as a white woman, like, I have some privilege, and yet I haven't been able to get my films funded because I was told, and that's a quote, like, my film is too controversial. Because I made a film about women who didn't want to have children. And it was not a promotional film. It was not a film that was trying to make anyone change their minds or things like that. It was portraying women of all ages, married or not, from different countries, different races, you know, like so many different things. And yet, according to the funders, I didn't have enough different perspectives. Making a film about not wanting kids was controversial. And so that's still a problem. Now I'm making a film about periods. Do you know how many producers I met with, and female producers, that went, what's the interest in that? Why would we want to see a film about that? Like, even though I'm a woman and I should have an easier time now than 5 years ago making a film, there's still a lot of prejudice about the subject matter.
So that was Magenta Baribeault from the Montreal Feminist Film Festival, with some obviously insightful stuff to say on the subject about, you know, whose stories are being told and whose perspectives. So if you're interested, check out the Montreal Feminist Film Festival. They have a launch event happening April 25th, where they're going to be revealing all the films that are in the festival April 25th from 5 to 7. And then the actual event is coming up May 5th to 13th, 8 days of films. Wow. So you can find them on Facebook, the Montreal Feminist Film Festival, or FFF Montreal. You're listening to FemAM on CJLO 1690 AM, and we're talking about women in film. I'm going to turn it over now to Sophia.
Hey,
and our special guest.
I am very, very excited about this segment that we have coming up today in the studio, right here, right now. We have Carol Nguyen.
Hello.
Carol is actually a friend of mine from high school. Fun fact, we went to the same high school, the Etobicoke School of the Arts, but she's also a super talented filmmaker, and she's also a student at Concordia, a film student. So I'm just going to give you the opportunity to introduce yourself, like some of the highlights from your film career, some of your biggest accomplishments, just to, you know, inform our listeners.
So I'm Carol. I'm a student at Montreal, at Concordia, in the film production program. I'm a TIFF Jump Cuts winner, a Sundance Ignite fellow, and a Share Her Journey ambassador, which is a campaign that promotes females and equality and people of color in film.
Wow, those titles just sound so official and like exciting. So you actually went to Sundance?
I did.
Recently, I saw like on your Instagram, you were like posting all these photos. Yeah. How was that?
It was life changing. I left that festival feeling like I could do anything.
Right. Did you see like a lot of films by like female directors or like women of color, stuff like that?
I did. And it was the first time that I saw an Asian female filmmaker, director presenting. So that really changed my perspective of how I saw myself in my position and how I saw just the role of a director.
Right.
So that was really incredible.
Right. Because I guess you could look to her as a role model and like go to her being like, okay, like how can I get to your level? That sort of thing.
Yeah. And it wasn't only that, like her film was all right. It wasn't my personal favorite. But to me, what really mattered was just seeing someone like me doing what I wanted to do and knowing that I could get to that position.
Yeah, well, especially like what we were talking about earlier with the behind the scenes, mm-hmm. it is so important to see people doing the behind the scenes. And since you're like a filmmaker, a director, you're doing all of that behind the scenes stuff. Mm-hmm. So super important. I was just, one of the first questions I have for you is, would you say that the Concordia Film Department is a supportive environment for young female filmmakers and by extension female filmmakers of color? I mean, especially like in light of the creative writing incident, I think we're all just sort of a bit like, I guess questioning, you know, whether like how supportive of an environment Concordia is mm-hmm. in the different arts departments.
Well, I haven't encountered anything negative about the Concordia Film Department in terms of like gender equality or like discrimination or anything. And that goes for gender and people of color.
Right. Okay.
I think demographically we have less people of color just because it's Montreal.
Right.
And, you know, as I guess statistics show, like there are less people of color in Montreal than in bigger cities than let's say Toronto. In terms of the acceptance ratio, it's very even. All of the classes, the gender ratio is very even as well. And the stories that I've seen in that have been told in class have been very supportive of female characters, and the teachers have been very supportive of the stories that we want to tell. In my class, 5 of the 7 films told this year had a female character as the lead role.
Right, right.
And I think 3 of them were over the age of 40.
Oh, so well, that's awesome.
It's a very supportive space. I would say for me, the problem doesn't occur in film school. Film school is a very supportive and equal space. The problem occurs when you step out of film school and go into the industry.
Right. Okay. Okay. So we were talking earlier about like the Bechdel test. Like, does that come up in like your studies or like in classroom discussions at all?
Not at all.
Okay.
Not
yeah.
at all.
Yeah. So I guess it would be good to include that. I guess the next question I have, maybe just what has been one of the biggest sort of setbacks for you in your film career, like as a female, or have there been any moments where it's just like jarring misogyny, if any, like.
I haven't experienced any personally. I've heard horror stories from filmmakers that I know. I think we're really lucky to be filmmakers today because there are so many programs coming out and so this whole movement of Me Too and, you know, this whole feminist movement that we don't even sometimes are conscious that we're living now is really supporting who I am, which is, you know, a woman of color, and is really helping me see that it's possible to do this. Like, I'd say for me, what was the barrier the most was not having enough representation to see myself go further in doing what I want to do.
Right.
Like,
right.
I never thought I would be a director. Like, oh, maybe I'd be a assistant director or a producer because I don't think I'd have enough courage or confidence or power to do that.
Yeah.
But once I started meeting female filmmakers and seeing Asian filmmakers and, oh, my God, they're able to direct Hollywood films and, oh, my God, they can do this. I started to expand my mind in what I could be. Like today, I think there's a movie coming out with Joker's girlfriend, Harley Quinn.
I saw you like shared it on your Facebook. Harley Quinn.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And an Asian female filmmaker from Sundance was selected to direct it, and she's the first Asian female to be selected to direct is it a Marvel or a DC movie or something like that?
DC. Okay.
Yeah. The first.
DC.
Fiona knows.
Yes, Fiona knows.
And just the thought of having someone who looks like me directing a Hollywood film, like when I was on the metro here, I was like, could I do Hollywood? Do I see myself doing that? Can I?
Yeah.
Is that a possibility?
Uh-huh.
So it's just really limiting not having girls, young girls and people of color or, you know, any minority not have that representation and that role model.
Right, right. Well, so it sounds like there is a lot of optimism and that we are having these exciting milestones, mm-hmm. like first female Asian director for a DC movie, or also like Black Panther, for example. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like that movie is kind of like its own milestone. So mm-hmm. there is hope.
Like... there is definitely hope. And we're going to talk a little bit more about some of these films that we've encountered that maybe mm-hmm. give us hope, or and maybe some that don't. So we're going to keep this conversation rolling about women in film here on Femme AM. Don't go away.
You're listening to CJLO 1690 AM.
Hey friends, you're still here. You're listening to CJLO 1690 AM and our only feminist talk radio show, Femme AM, talking about women in film. And now we're opening it up to the floor to our Women's Plus Collective members and our guest to just talk a little bit more on this subject. We talked about some tropes. We talked about the Bechdel test, the storytellers. What is the representation like amongst our storytellers? So we're mostly talking about mainstream film, but kind of now turning it out around to our own perspectives and our own experiences consuming some of these films. So does anybody want to kick it off?
Okay, well, I like movies that impacted us. Mm-hmm. Is that sort of the question?
Yeah, it's really anything. I mean, for example,
it's anything you want.
We didn't really get to touch on this a little bit earlier, but you know, there are some films kind of coming out in the last couple of years that are doing a good job of bringing in higher female representation. Right. Some of those still have problems in other ways.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example. Okay, I saw a movie recently. Everybody knows Wes Anderson's Isle of Dogs.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm.
I was already a little bit on edge going into this movie. I'd heard about some of the kind of representation of the Japanese characters, so I was, you know, a little bit wary. I was surprised to find, and I probably shouldn't have been, but I was surprised to find that I was really not happy with the representation of female characters either. And that was because the very first female dog that we see literally turns all the male dogs' heads. They look up at her and they say, "That's so-and-so. Wasn't she a show dog?"
Ouch. What's frustrating about that, too, is that they're animals, not humans.
Exactly,
and the
exactly.
fact that they're just so gendered.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There's another female dog that ends up having puppies, and there's really not that much happens that between these female characters. And even at one point, so the human character who is kind of the hero of the film, the rah-rah student who's, you know, going up against the government in this minority movement, who is happened to be played by an American instead of maybe a Japanese character, as it might have been a little bit better, but an American exchange student, at one point just randomly she's reviewing what has happened and she says, "Oh my gosh, I think I have a crush on this boy." Just completely out of the blue. Out of the blue. Like, there was no build up to it. There, she had never met him. He didn't know she existed. She's just, like, standing there in front of all the news articles, talking into her recorder for the, you know, for the school newspaper, and just all of a sudden stops herself and flusters and says that. So
but that's also in the trailer, too.
Like, yeah, it is in the trailer. Yeah.
Scene in the trailer, which is really odd. Yeah. And it's like,
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, I had some issues with that.
Another recent movie that I had an issue with was Baby Driver. And, like, I mean, Edgar Wright, love what he does with editing, but honestly, I thought it was very old-fashioned, the way that, like, the female character was, like, portrayed at this kind of, like, light at the end of the tunnel and the, like, saving grace.
Mm-hmm. We are the saviors, don't you know?
Yeah. No. I actually had a problem with Wonder Woman. Honestly, it's an amazing movie. It's awesome that we're seeing, because I'm a big comic book fan. So it's awesome seeing, like, a female-led comic book movie. I mean, everyone's advocating for a Black Widow movie, which we're still waiting for, please. I mean, we're getting a Harley Quinn movie, which is pretty awesome. But there's also issues with her that I have as well from Suicide Squad. But with Wonder Woman, I previously talked about this with one of my friends. And pretty much the male characters have more, like, lines than Wonder Woman, which is very odd since the title of the movie is Wonder Woman. So it's quite odd that, like, they gave Steve Trevor most of the lines where it should have been Wonder Woman. And I found him sort of mansplaining for her and just thinking that she was like really dumb. And they also show like but they're kind of like showing like the misogyny that happened back in like those times, because since the movie takes place during World War I, so when she walks into like the war council, everyone goes silent, like stares at her, and like Steve Trevor's like immediate response to that is like, oh yeah, this is my sister and she like has mental issues, so like let me just like shove her away, which is like, that, why would you even bother?
I mean sometimes it's like showing the misogyny is like a story point to be like, oh, look how we've changed.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, no, it hasn't. Nothing has changed. Like, nothing.
But the fact you have to use that as a story element, that's kind of like falling back on like the fact that there's a woman at all in the movie.
Yeah.
It's like, you don't have to make a thing about having.
It's astonishing. And then also with Suicide Squad, Harley Quinn, I mean, she's also in an abusive relationship with the Joker, which is pretty much talked about and is evident in the comics. And they kind of just show their relationship as like a really lovey-dovey, like, they both love each other and they're like, they're meant for each other. And it's like, that's not the case. It's really weird. And then also she's very over sexualized, especially in that one scene from the trailer where she's getting changed and everyone just staring at her. And she's like, what? And it's like, no, that's her entire outfit is sexualized. And then one of the two women of color in the movie, Katana, she hardly speaks. Like, she's just there as like a plot device and doesn't really do much.
One thing that you said too, in moving from the comics to a film adaptation, a lot of times there is something that gets lost in the film adaptations, especially with big Hollywood films, because, you know, maybe the excuse is that you have to reduce this big long thing to something much more, you know, consumable. It shouldn't be the case, exactly, because what ends up happening is they're actually sacrificing character development.
Yeah.
They are sacrificing these things that make us human in order to kind of flatten and fit them into a mold.
Because, for Suicide Squad, there's the live action and then there's also the animated movie. And in the animated movie, they do sort of shine the light on that, and Harley Quinn becomes, like, her own person, and, like, she sort of kicks his ass and is just like, I'm not dealing with you anymore. But she does sort of go back to him, but it's only because she wants to keep her other teammates safe from like being attacked by him. So her whole, like, it's really interesting, her story arc there, and then they just sort of like wiped it out. I was like, no, she's just really in love with the Joker, who's a complete and utter psycho. So it just makes me sad to see that happen.
If I can add, like, I haven't seen Wonder Woman, but like, I kind of like, there's this idea that I see a lot, is that we need quote-unquote strong female characters. So a lot of the movies you see about women are women in the place of like a male superhero or star, and it's really making it so that the women are more like a masculine, like masculine, and for some reason those stories are more valid than women who are a bit more like, have more feminine traits. And I think that's problematic, because even if it's a woman in this place, you're still putting emphasis on like, masculine traits are favored over feminine traits.
Actually,
yeah, just to add to what you're saying, I was on Netflix the other day, and like, you know how they have the categories of like, one of them was like, it was like comedies with a strong female lead. But no, which is like,
it's awesome.
It is really good that they're like, that they have that category, but it's just like, it doesn't have to be strong female, like, I'm a strong woman, like, like, it's just, we just want more accurate representation, we want more women telling stories, and but it doesn't have to be strong women.
It can be,
and that's okay.
It can't be like strong women, because it's like putting this like, women as like being perfect too.
Exactly, and that's one dimensional. That's again one dimensional. We want three dimensional characters.
That's why everyone should watch Lady Bird.
Lady Bird was
really, really good.
Oh my god, so good.
I think what happens is that in the attempt to round out female characters, maybe writers are looking to rounded male characters and just kind of superimposing those values onto female characters without considering what actually makes, you know, a woman a woman. What are the struggles that she deals with? What are the kind of, what's the frame of mind, and what are the thoughts that go through her head, and what are the what's the context that she's dealing with on a daily basis. So instead of looking at that and maybe even asking people, you know, what do you experience? Mm-hmm. It's just kind of like, well, we'll just take what the guy characters are like and just throw that, on there.
That's so true. And that's why we need more female writers, mm-hmm. and like women, yeah. working behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, Lady Bird's such a good example, yeah, of that though. Definitely. And also like the mother-daughter dynamic in that movie is the most accurate thing I have ever seen. Like, do not beautiful. See that movie with your mom. It will be an emotional,
yeah.
experience.
Yeah, definitely.
It will trigger you.
There are scenes in the movie where you just can't help but like tear up or like break down and cry because it's just so accurate.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, Greta Gerwig is a really good example of like an awesome female writer. Also, Frances Ha. I don't know if, such a good movie. It's on Netflix, I'm pretty sure.
Yes, I loved that
one. I watched it
one.
Not that long ago, yeah. So.
I watched that in a blanket fort in my living room with one of my best friends, and it was hilarious the time we had watching that movie. It was so great.
That sounds like such a nice moment.
Bonding experience, you
and,
know.
And, like, Frances Ha is so relatable because, like, she doesn't have her life put together.
No, mm-hmm. no, she's a mess. But it's, like, relatable. But again, it's human. It's just so human. And like, we've all sort of been in that place, you know? Yeah. Another example that I have of like, I guess like a positive representation. I don't know if you guys have seen it. Diary of a Teenage Girl.
Yeah,
it came out a few years back, mm-hmm. but it takes place in the 70s. It has, it's the Swedish guy. What's his?
Skarsgård?
One of the Skarsgård. Alexander Skarsgård. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
His dad.
Oh, is that his? There's a family of them. There's a bunch of them. But it's the main
Alexander
one. And... The Alex. I think it's Alexander, the really hot one. I think they're all hot. They're like these beautiful Swedish men, and they all act. But it takes place in the 70s, and it's actually based off these recordings of this teenage girl. Like, she had this, like, instead of writing in a diary, she spoke into this recorder, mm-hmm. and the entire movie is based off of that, and it depicts her sexual awakening. And so she has this like sexual relationship with her kind of stepdad, or with her mom's boyfriend, who is played by off Saturday Night Live, what's her name, the blonde one, I'm not remembering Kristen Wiig, yes. Yeah. Everyone's helping me out here. It's really great. Anyway, it's a really good movie because it shows like this teenage girl having her sexual awakening, but she's in control of it. Like, she's sexually assertive and discovering it. Mm-hmm. And it's not like her being objectified in a sexual, like, it's just so refreshing. Mm-hmm. And it's also based off this actual recording of this girl. So I think that's what makes it really great. Anyway, check it out, guys. Good movie.
Yeah, super lively discussion here. And we've had a lot to talk about during the show today. And so I wanted to thank everybody for tuning in. We've been talking about women in film on Femme AM. And we had this lively little discussion here with, of course, Sophia, Mac, yes. Fiona, and our guest, Carol. Thank you guys all for coming in and talking on the subject and contributing to the episode. So just a little recap, really. We talked about some of the tropes, character tropes about women in as they are portrayed in the mass media, and why some of those things can be harmful, mm-hmm. both for how they are viewed by men, or how they internalize some of those things, mm-hmm. And just how flat those characters are. We want to see real women in films, real storylines, real life women in these stories. And we talked about the Bechdel test, the Montreal Feminist Film Festival coming up. So really, I just wanted to thank everybody for coming in and talking with us. One last thought I can leave you with today when you're looking at films is to just be a little bit more critical. When I asked Magenta from the Montreal Feminist Film Festival what she thought we needed to do as consumers, she said very simply, I think we need to be a little bit less forgiving. And,
yes.
you know, just Preach. Because, yeah, just because you enjoy a filmmaker, if you see something that is problematic in those films, I think it's fair to call that out, talk about it, tell people what you witness and what you would like to see that
change.
Well,
as consumers and as the audience, mm-hmm. we do have that power.
That is kind of one of the only things that we have power over and, you know, where our dollars are spent. So hopefully we're going to see more change happen at the top. But for now, this is what we got. So thank you so much for tuning in. This has been Femme AM.